Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Stranahan. I'm a senior electrical engineering and math major, and I'm going to be talking about some interpretations of quantum mechanics and with a special focus on the many worlds of interpretation. So we're going to begin with sort of a history and philosophy of physics and as it has come about through history, beginning with, we're going to start with Newton. Obviously, physics began much longer before him. But in Newton's time and before Newton, physics had a very clear and simple connection to the physical world around us. We could take our mathematical equations and we could clearly identify what it meant to the world around us. For example, I could apply a constant force and I could see this bottle of water accelerate across the table. We were able to formulate an equation to model this behavior. That equation, F equals ma, also on the slides here, had a very clear connection to the physical world around us. Flash forward to the story of Newton sitting under the tree. Newton sees an apple fall, he knows the apple has mass, and he watches the apple accelerate to the ground. From this, he can reason that there must be some force acting on it. That force is gravity, hence now we've discovered gravity. So we come along to 1926, and Erwin Schrödinger gives us the Schrödinger wave equation. It's a differential equation that we can solve for a wave, but we don't really know what does this wave describe? What is the connection that this wave makes to the physical world? And Schrödinger had a guess. Schrödinger guessed that this wave showed the, taking the electron as an example, Schrödinger believed that this was the charge distribution of the electron in space, but this didn't really match up with what his experiments were showing about the charge density of an electron. So we were kind of in limbo for about 6 months until Max Born came and gave us the probability density function. And I say gave, he actually more like stumbled upon this probability density function. But in July 1926, so about 6 months after Schrödinger gave us the wave equation, Max Born discovered that by taking the complex conjugate of the wave function and the wave function, multiplying them together, we could get the probability density that would give us the space or the location of a particle, finding a particle in free space. And for this, he was given the Nobel Prize in 1954. So kind of like we've talked about a little bit in class, how we've got about 90% done. We just kind of need to fill in some other problems here. But it's one of those stories. We had a few more issues just to kind of work out, but then we'd be done, right? Well, Schrödinger, he came along and he gave us this paradox. Didn't really sit well with him that his equation didn't really mean anything. It was just a mathematical tool. And he presented the paradox of Schrödinger's cat. And the way this paradox works, for those of you who don't know, Schrödinger describes a situation where a cat is placed inside of a closed box. And in this closed box is also an element, a radioactive element that decays. And we picked an element that decays or has a half-life such that there's a 50% probability that it will decay in the duration while it's in the box and a 50% chance that it won't. Also in the box, we put an emission detector, which is tied to a hammer, which is shown here. And that hammer will fall, smashing a bottle of poison. So if this element decays, the bottle of poison will be smashed. And if it does not, the bottle of poison will remain intact. The bottle of poison will remain intact and the cat will remain living. So to make this story simple, what it amounts to is we've got a 50% chance that the cat comes out of the box alive, 50% chance that it comes out dead. So the problem that this presented, the paradox, is before we open the box, the wave function tells us that this cat is existing in two different states. It's both alive and dead at the same time. The wave nature of the cat puts it in two states, and that's just not how it works in our world. It's either alive or it's dead. And at some point, it crosses that boundary between alive and dead, or it stays alive the entire time. So this was one of those, you know, just little 10% that we just had to work out, you know, not going to be a problem, right? So some very smart fellows, they got together, Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr. They got together in 1927, now a year after Schrodinger has given us his wave equation. They get together in Copenhagen and kind of discuss some of these problems, and Schrodinger's cat is one of those problems that they discuss. During their collaboration in Copenhagen, Heisenberg and Bohr, they pose a solution to Schrodinger's cat problem and some other problems. And that idea is the idea of a wave function collapse. We've actually seen this example of a wave function collapse in class, and I'll refresh your memories here. Flash over to this. We'll see the wave packet run, and you'll see we have the wave function here. And that spike right there, that's your wave function collapse. So run it again. We have this continuum of where the particle might be, but when we test for it, the wave function collapses, and with that collapse, we know immediately where that particle is. So this was the solution that Heisenberg and Bohr came up with in 1927, and they decided that the Schrodinger wave equation didn't have any real connection to the world. It was more of like a mathematical tool. It was something that let us arrive at the probability density function, and this was something that we could use to take a guess, an educated guess, a probabilistic guess at where this particle might be in space. So how does Heisenberg and Bohr, how do Heisenberg and Bohr respond to the problem of Schrodinger's cat? Well, they say that while the cat is in the box, or I guess they don't really consider while the cat is in the box, they say while the cat's in the box, we have the probability density function, and it's going to look something like this. We'll have two states. We'll have the alive state and the dead state, and we'll have a magnitude of 1/2 for both alive and dead. And when we open up this box, one of these is going to collapse down to zero. The other one will shoot up to a value of 1. This is the idea that they proposed as a solution to what happens in this experiment and what happens in all quantum experiments. So we kind of put a corollary onto this problem, and it's kind of a problem that the Copenhagen interpretation has to deal with. Well, suppose that we put a friend of yours inside the box with the cat. Well, my friend will see immediately whether this cat is alive or whether it's dead, and he will always have a wave function that looks like this. My friend's going to be very nice. He's going to stay silent while inside the box, and he's not going to reveal to me what that state is. So to me, outside the box, I still have this wave function. Now what? This is another sort of paradox here. And Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg say, this isn't really a problem. The wave function and the probability density function, it really just reflects our knowledge of the system. So it's okay that your friend, who has more knowledge of the system, has a different wave function than you outside the box. So, to recap a little bit, the Copenhagen interpretation is kind of just an extension of Max Born's probability density function, and we just kind of give some definitions as to what we mean by this probability density function and what it means to take a quantum measurement. And mathematically speaking, the the probability density function, or the wave function collapse of the density function, is really just a dropping out of some eigenvalues from the process when the wave function collapses. So on to the many worlds interpretation. About 30 years go by, and Hugh Everett is a chemical engineer turned mathematician turned physicist. He is, let me get the quote right, make sure I don't mess this one up. He's sitting in his commons at Princeton, and he's discussing with a friend, and I quote here, "After a slosh or two of sherry, the ridiculous things about the implications of quantum mechanics." And Everett decided that the idea of a wave function collapse just didn't really sit well with him. It was just too ridiculous. The implication of a wave function collapse, Occam's razor just said, this doesn't make sense. How do we have two different functions defining some particle? We have the wave function, and then we have the collapsed function. And he cites Occam's razor, saying Occam's razor being that the simplest solution is most often the correct one. He cites this, and he says, this can't be right. And he decides to make this the focus of his PhD thesis. So in 1957, Everett submits a thesis entitled On the Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. He submits this to Princeton University, and also in 1957, he submits to the journal Reviews in Modern Physics a paper entitled Relative State Formulation of Quantum Mechanics. The idea behind Hugh Everett's relative state formulation is that rather than the wave function collapsing, we have a decoherence, a quantum decoherence at the point of measurement. So we have this wave function initially, and when we make our measurement, this wave function stays the same. Just the difference is, this is one reality, this is the other reality, and this becomes the new 100% for one reality. This becomes the new 100% for the other reality. So it's kind of far out. It says that the wave function is a real thing. It really describes what happens in nature. The problem is it doesn't describe what happens in our reality. It describes what happens in the reality as a whole. So how does he respond to Schrodinger's cat? Well, what happens is we have the cat in a box, and the cat does exist in both states. It exists in both a live and a dead state. We just don't know which state it's in our reality. So when we open up the box, we reveal the cat is alive in our reality, while in another reality, another you or another physicist doing this experiment finds that the cat is dead. It's the exact same world, just this quantum decision has come out in a different way. So to kind of, I guess, recap this, Everett says that wave function collapse just cannot happen by Occam's razor, and instead proposes this solution that has an infinite number of universes. Yeah, he was labeled kind of a loony or a crackpot, and he wasn't really given much time to explain this. He was kind of driven out of the world of physics. And it's actually kind of interesting. He ends up in the world of military contracting, working. Let's see, who was it that he ends up working for? He works for the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group, and he does some statistical analysis on the distribution and effects of nuclear fallout. So it doesn't end all that badly for him, but he's kind of kicked out of the world of physics. And it comes down to another man, Bryce DeWitt, to tell us, to further the work of the many worlds interpretation. And it's Bryce DeWitt who actually gives the many worlds interpretation its name. As you recall, Hugh Everett gave it the relative state formation name, and Bryce DeWitt renames it to this kind of more catchy many worlds interpretation that kind of encompasses what actually happened in the many worlds. So it's kind of funny, I've read some conflicting stories here. I've seen one survey that shows that about 58% of studying physicists agree with the many worlds interpretation, while I've seen another that shows about 60% agree with Copenhagen. So I'm not really sure which is now the prevailing idea, but this one does have the support of Stephen Hawking and Feynman, for what it's worth. But you can take it for what it's worth. It seems to be about evenly split between Copenhagen and many worlds. These are some of my references. The papers that Everett wrote for his thesis and to the journal are available online, and gives you links to those and some other interesting stories about that. If there are any questions.
Thanks, David.
Yes, sir.
So Everett says basically for every decision that you make, and like, so every instant you can make a decision, there forms two worlds. Like right now I could drop the pencil, throw the pencil, hold it. Like, does he say that each
it's
one
not based on a, it's not based on a human decision. Although there is another theory that kind of is, it's a more of a philosophical theory, but this is a mathematical physical theory that is based off of quantum measurements. So the idea of Schrodinger's cat kind of has the parallel of measuring an electron spin as spin up or spin down.
Oh.
So every time I go to ping an electron and I see if it's spin up or spin down, I find that the electron is spin up. Another person exactly like me in another world that has just spawned off finds that this thing is spin down, which kind of brings up the weird philosophy of, well, how many me's are there? And Everett kind of answers, well, there's only one you, but there are trillions of Davids. So take that for what it's worth. Let the philosophers play with it.
You deal with like binary situations where it's alive or dead. There's multiple solutions to some problems.
And it does extend to those. You have your wave function that looks, or your probability distribution function that looks like this. Well, every one of these can happen.
There's an infinite
continuum of how many worlds can spawn off. And there's actually kind of an interesting problem that goes with that too, the idea of conservation of energy. They're saying that, well, if you're creating all these new worlds, the conservation of energy is just thrown out the window. And to which he responds, well, no, the energy is weighted by its probability. So not much energy goes into this world, whereas quite a bit goes into these worlds up here.
So going off that like distribution, we're saying that a distribution like that would be, say, for just two things in a system interacting, there's a high probability of many different solutions. And in a world with so many things interacting, just like with the amount of atoms increases the peak, wouldn't that say that there's a huge probability with these huge systems that there's only one way this world is really going to go?
Yes, actually, which is why many worlds has been offered as one of those possible explanations for trying to remember the fine-tuned universe, this idea that our universe is just too perfect to exist. It kind of goes to what you said. There are so many possibilities, but only a very small number of them actually turn out to support life, to support us, to support our calculations. Well, that's the path that our consciousness has followed. So all of these other worlds, they do exist. We just don't have, we or nobody really exists in them because they just can't support life.
That's very not that sweet.
It's kind of crazy. It's really far out. It's like straight out of science fiction. Yeah. You have a question?
So I'm assuming there are counterarguments to this, pulling out Occam's razor on the guy, right? Saying like, okay, well,
that's why I said it kind of sounds like a bit of a crackpot answer to say that Occam's razor supports this, but when you get down to the math of it, the idea of many worlds is actually mathematically more simple than the idea of having two different functions govern a waveform, having one waveform and then having one collapsed waveform. Mathematically, it's simpler to just say that all of these exist and just have one equation.
As far as testing for this goes, at the time of measurement, it was seen like, you know, once this value is certain, a new universe would be created. So there would have to be some sort of communication between the two, wouldn't there, to say, well, I was chosen, therefore you branch off and be created. So could one test for this somehow?
Could we look for parallel universes? I don't know. Maybe that's what we'll find at CERN. Maybe we'll find parallel universes. Right now, there's no definitive way to test, to find if there's a parallel universe or not. It's kind of purely like a mathematical or theory idea right now. But maybe we will get to a point where we'll be able to look for parallel universes, and maybe we'll either confirm or deny this theory.
Okay, any more questions?
So what if you don't test for anything?
We don't test for anything, then it's as good as any other theory that doesn't make predictions. It's not really a theory at that point if it's not testable. And right now, some people claim that this is testable and some people don't, so it's kind of up in the air as to whether you want to call it a theory or just an interpretation. But until we can test for it, I guess it's really just an interpretation.
Okay, so any other questions? All right.